If we play a game of telephone, and I whisper something to Andy, and he whispers to Andy, by the time he gets back to me, it's completely different, right? But that's because it's a game. It's not important. I'll give you another example of something like that. Let's say that Bobby went to the doctor today and discovered from the doctor that he had 2 weeks to live. And there was this one medicine that came from a plant. And the plant only existed, in the Amazon, okay? And there was a certain village with a really long, complicated Amazonian name. And a plant with a really weird Amazonian name. But if he went and got that plant and chewed its leaves, he would live for another 50 years or another 100 years. And then I whisper that name to Andy. You best believe when he gives that information to Kathy, he repeats it and spells it and repeats it and spells it. And she gets exactly what that word is. And then she's going to give it all the way around. And by the time Bobby gets it, it's going to be the correct information because it's life or death. Right? That's a little bit different than a game of telephone. You know, it's a game of life and death, which is what this is. If you get this right, if you get right with God, if you understand, then you live. And if you don't, then you die. So that's the feeling in which this information is passed on. It's not, oh, Abraham, blah, 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 blah. It's not like that. It's not like some play off Broadway or some crap like that. It's like life and death. And when they finally get to the writing, they prove what I'm trying to say in the way they address the written word. When they have Hebrew and they have the Torah and they have it written down, everything that's instituted about how that's copied is so insane. And I've mentioned this before, but it's been years, so I'll just mention it again. When they go to make a Torah scroll, so they're going to take, say, the first five books of the Bible, the books of Abraham, the books of Moses. They're going to take the law and all that and the Genesis, and they're going to write it down. What it doesn't look like is somebody has it over here, and they're like typing it like that. You know, they're like, okay, and Abraham and Abimelech, and there's typos. That's not what it looks like, okay? That's what people think they do. Or they have a guy with a candle, and he's like, I can't really read it. And then, that's not what's happening, okay? It's a huge event in Jewish culture. It's a huge event. And the priestly class, which is the current people, are called Chabad, which are the descendants of the people that, you know, for instance, Paul was with, right? Who are the descendants of, like, the Levites, okay? There's a chain of priestly intellectual people, okay? And here's the way it works. It's going to take a team. Let's just say the four of us are the team. And we're going to copy Genesis 22, okay? We're on Genesis 22 right now. And it says, now it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. Now it's going to be in Hebrew, of course. Okay, it's going to be written this way from the other direction. But here's how that works. So the first word's now. So we've got copies of it and we're all scholars. We're all like 60 or 70 years old. We're all Jewish intellectual scholars who run like Torah schools. All four of us. So I said, all right. Genesis 22, the first word is now, right? And Andy looks and confirms now. And Andy looks and confirms now. And Bobby looks and confirms now. And I write, the first letter is N. And I write an N. And I pass it to Andy, who looks at it and identifies it as an N and goes, yes, that is indeed an N. Turns it around to those guys. They look at it and go, that is an N. They give it back to me and I go, the next letter is O. Right? Yes. Oh. It's definitely an O. It takes months to write this down. Months. This is how they do it. I spent an entire day with a person who just did it. Okay? She was a leader from the Chabad, which is a Hasidic, basically, like I said, it's the Pharisees in the modern day. and they're highly she was so educated, it was unbelievable the stuff that she knew. And so when we talked about this kind of stuff, it was mind-boggling, right? Because it was just, she just knew so much, right? And she was allowed to be there. She wasn't a lead person. She wasn't doing any writing. That was the old rabbi guys. But she was allowed to be there because they bring them like water, and they tap their heads off when they're sweating because it's so important. And it takes months. And then when they do it, when they finish it, by the way, I finished a line, and then we confirm the line, and then Bobby's job is to confirm that there's supposed to be 47 letters in that line. So he counts, without looking at the words, he counts the letters to confirm there's 47 letters. And by the time it's over, and you can look it up online, there's an exact number. I want to say 186,512, whatever. There's an exact number of letters. And then we all recount it, every single letter. And we confirm it's 187,405, whatever it is. And we confirm that. And then there's a giant party. Mm-hmm. Giant party. And it's put into gold stuff. And we ship it to wherever because we're doing it for a synagogue. There's a new synagogue opening up in Trenton, New Jersey or whatever. And so we've created this for them. And so we do this whole thing. We have a giant party. And we go there and it arrives as a giant party. The rabbi there is probably one of the four because that's what it's for his church, right? That's what they do. They found Torah scrolls from 1,000 years and 1,000 miles apart. And this Torah scrolls, these two Torah scrolls, 1,000 years and 1,000 miles had one letter wrong. One letter. And it was just like an ick. One letter. Out of 180, however many thousand, 300,000, however many thousand letters it is, okay? So that's the level that we're talking about. So when people are like, oh, they copy blah, 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 and you don't really know and blah, 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 that's completely wrong. Furthermore, we had Daniel. We had it done. And then when they discovered the Nag Hammadi, when they discovered the new stuff, when that little shepherd boy throws a rock into a cave, hears a crash of noise, goes up there, and there's all these giant earthenware vessels full of scrolls. Okay? And you guys have heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? And they go and pull it out. Maybe you don't, maybe you know, maybe you don't, but in there was a copy of Daniel, which is word for word the same one. That's insane. That's literally pre-Christ. That was, say 2,200 years ago, 2,500 years ago, the age of that Daniel scroll. And then the modern one. And they're like word for word. And I've seen that with my own two eyes. I've seen the two scrolls, the modern one and the old one, put side by side. I've seen it with my own two eyes. It's word for word. So the point is, even though it's older information and even though it's transferred like that, we have to realize the great sacred quality of that, and we have to realize the power of God in sustaining that. If God wanted Andy to write something down because it was going to affect thousands of people for thousands of years, millions of people for thousands of years, He will make sure that Andy writes it down right, that it's exact. He'll give him exactly the words, and Andy will be in prayer. And we're talking about Moses. We're talking about a guy so important to God that when he died, God buried him himself. Okay? It's the only such story in the Bible. It's completely crazy. But God comes and takes him. He doesn't want anybody to mess with him. Like, he's so powerful and important because he started this whole thing, right? I mean, think about how hated he must have been. First of all, he pulled the entire workforce out of Egypt, okay? That's probably why there's not a whole lot of pyramids, you know, around this time or after this. The pyramids are from a lot earlier because they don't have any, like, a workforce anymore. So the Egyptians have got to be really mad at him. And then they go and they conquer a whole other place and kill all these people and conquer the place, right? They got to be mad at him. I mean, nobody likes this guy. He doesn't want anybody to be able to venerate him either, like hold him up as God, because people talk about the books of Moses. Right, they talk about how big a deal Moses is, which is true, but they don't want that, you know. But if he existed like they had his body, they could venerate him as some kind of god, Or the bad guys get hold of him and you know, desecrate his body and do all kinds of bad things. So God comes and buries him himself, and no one will ever know because God buried him. He could be 1,000 feet, but it could be 1,000 miles, blows up. He could be anywhere. God buried him, and nobody knows but God where Abraham's buried. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, Moses. Anyway, that's my point. My point is that people talk about stuff being old or stuff being copied or whatever they say, but you got to remember how specific and how important it was and how careful everybody was when they transferred the information. It was life or death to them. All through here, what happens? That guy, you know, meets up with Abraham and Sarah. Abraham says that's his sister, so he takes Sarah back to his house, has a dream that night. God says, you're dead, man. It's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that's happening all the time. You don't want to mess around, you know. And people, this happens to people all the time. Even in the New Testament, you see, people mock God or try to mock God or do something stupid, and then bad stuff happens, like how Herod dies. One of my favorite stories is how Herod, after all the nonsense that Herod did, which was a lot of nonsense, like killing John the Baptist, like a whole lot of nonsense, right? Like being involved in Jesus' whole thing. I mean, Herod's a bad, bad man, right? He's just a bad guy. And after all of that, he's just, you know, chilling up on the throne, being cool, like being, you know, pimp daddy Herod. And somebody gives him credit for something, you know, God had done. He takes credit for God, like he's that cool. And then it describes how he dies, right? But that's one of my favorite things because the order. So he dies, and he's eaten by worms, but that's not what it says, right? Because you die and you go in the ground and get eaten by worms. It reverses the order. So go look it up. He gets eaten by worms and dies. So he's sitting there on the throne trying to be cool, crown, gold, jewels, like boom, bing, bling, bling, right? And then all of a sudden, worms, like maggots eating him. I mean, and he just like, I would have loved to have seen that. Okay, maybe not like filmed it necessarily, but I mean, he was such a piece of, you know, dung, right? The sources are good.
They are good.
He was such a piece of dung, and to have him mocking God and then die like that, like it was in reverse order. Yeah. I mean, this is what happens. You remember the guys that were lying to Peter and those guys about giving the money and stuff and what happened to them? I mean, the culture that we're talking about, the Hebrew people, really got this. Like, you do not mess with God. You do not mess with the Word of God. You do not offend God. If you do anything wrong, you die. It is bad, right? So that's how they're transferring this information, with that in mind, like it's life or death. Just like if I was telling Randy, hey, giving him a piece of information that was going to save his life, and it was like three words, he would get those three words right, no matter what. It would be so specific. Like, okay, spell that again. Triptomycin. What is that? T-R-I. Whatever it was, right? It would be so specific. And that's how they do this. So people think somebody jotted some stuff down at some point, like had a pad, like, and it was like, you know. That is not it. That is not it. And that information, by the way, that way of doing things got transferred to the New Testament because those guys were all Jews. And the guys that were in charge of that group were highly educated Jews. So you've got Matthew for starters. Then you've got people that do this on purpose, like want to track it on purpose, like Luke, who is a doctor. Okay? But then you've got Paul. And Paul would have been at one of those ceremonies where they transferred the Torah. He would have known all of that. He was a Pharisee among Pharisees. He was like, you know, it was like the head of a department at Harvard or whatever. That's the kind of level of power Paul was. So when this information gets transferred, when he's talking to, saying at the end, he's getting near the end of his life, he's like, hey, have Timothy come see me. Have him bring me my scrolls. This is for real. This is not like, hey, I got some paperwork kind of bundled up with a rubber band. This is like scrolls, where he has treated these letters and the stuff that's happening in the New Testament like the Torah. And he's got to make sure this is getting recorded properly and passed on properly. And we know that that's what happened, because we know that John did that. And we know that by the time John's apprentice was teaching that he had Moses' information, and his apprentice's apprentice. So only two generations. His apprentice's apprentice comments on almost every single book of the New Testament in his works called Against Heresies. I'm talking about Irenaeus. So the point is that we know that they did that exact same thing with the New Testament. So it's not like, oh, the Old Testament's really reliable and cool. The Jews did all this cool stuff with the letters and blah, blah. And then the new guys were like, whatever, man, just tell them Paul said so. That wasn't what happened. They transferred that level of commitment to the New Testament. And so when people are like, oh, we don't have whatever, blah, 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 just don't worry about that, okay? That they're working off of incorrect assumptions, because they were very specific. And by the time you're into literally the middle of the second century, so only 50 years after John dies, you have a complete New Testament, word for word. And here's what I mean. When Irenaeus quotes, or Irenaeus, however you want to pronounce it, when Irenaeus quotes the Bible in his essays about heresies, those quotes we can find because they're the same. You understand? In 150 AD, he quotes something that we pull up in our Bible as the same quote. There's no big gap. There's no, because that's what they try to tell everybody, this big gap. Oh man, we don't have any of the original manuscripts and all that stuff, you know, burned by the Romans and stuff, and everybody just kind of guessed and made it up. That is not what happened. It was like this guy, and then this guy, and then this guy. We had everything. They were very careful. We even have a note where one of the people says right after John died, the guy writes a letter to Ephesus, and he says, pull out the letter that Paul sent. So in other words, they have copies of these letters, and he's asking them to refer to that, just like you would Scripture. And that's 100 AD, 102. The point is that that's how specific this is. So that's the reason I went on that little side journey is because when they mention Philistines, and it's hundreds of years before Philistines, or they mention the storehouses of Ramses, but it doesn't appear that Ramses was the actual guy, it seems confusing. But there's a reason, and the reason is if you're going to establish a place, if I was telling Andy to meet me in Woodland Park, I wouldn't use the original Native American word. Let's say the Native American word was Kentakwa. I wouldn't say, meet me at Kentakwa. You'd be like, the heck is Kentakwa? Like, okay, meet me in downtown Woodland Park. Oh, okay. See, I would use rational things that people could understand, right? That might have been what it was for 1,000 years. They had a lot of teepees and tents and stuff set up here or whatever. That might have been what it was like 1,000 years ago. But I'm talking to right now about this place that's called Woodland Park and has been for hundreds of years and will be for hundreds more. So if I write down, I met Andy in Woodland Park, everybody that reads this for the next couple of years are going to understand that a whole lot better. So that's why they say, oh, they lived in the place of the Philistines. The Philistines aren't there yet. Okay. Does that make sense? I'm sorry for the side note, but whenever you read that, and if you're paying attention, you're like, wait a minute. The Philistines weren't really around during Abraham's time. They were somewhere on their island, and that's the other possibility, by the way, that he went far away somewhere, which is unlikely, but he could have gone far away somewhere. But so that's 20 and 21. So we're actually covering like a couple chapters of a class. We might be done by 2020. That's so cool. We're almost halfway. I mean, it won't be long.
When you said that, you know, they discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls, how long have they been in that cave?
Thousands of years. A long, long time. Yeah, it was so dry. They're in these big sort of vessels like clay, right? And so they're protected, but they're in this cave, and they're in the Dead Sea. They're in the desert, right? It's so dry that everything is set there, right? Yeah, you have ever noticed that sometimes? Like sometimes you leave something out, and if you leave something out and like it's like the south or there's humidity, it like rots or gets mold. If you ever left something out that it just dried into like a McDonald's French fry under your seat, Right? Four years later, you're like, this thing, I could write with this. I could dip it in ink and write with it. But it's still recognizable as a French fry, right? It's like sometimes when things are so dry, they just lock in position, and these things just got locked. And they sat there, hidden away. Nobody would ever go there. And I want to say it was like a kid was playing around and threw a rock and heard something break, hit one of the vessels.
Shepherd.
Yeah, like a shepherd.
He was looking for a sheep that was...
He was looking for a renegade sheep that had run away. See, there you go. That's very apropos, by the way. A shepherd looking for a lost sheep found that. That's, I like that. That's good stuff.
He threw the rock in because the thought was the rock hits and then the sheep runs back out.
He hears a crashing noise because he hits one of those pots. Very, very cool stuff. Very cool stuff. And a couple of the other things I've referred to, like the Amarna letters or like the... I can't remember, Akrabanipal or whatever his name is in Nineveh. There's these libraries where they collected this stuff, and most of it gets destroyed. And it's very hard to hold stuff for 2,000-3,000 years, right? But they've actually found stuff, you know, several thousand years old, archaeologists. That's why Isis was destroying Nineveh. I don't know if you saw this, but if you want to just like, you know, have, you just like feel like a good cry, go ahead and pull this up. Where they blow up Nineveh, Isis does, trying to destroy all the artifacts and stuff so that we can't find anything else that supports, you know, our cause or whatever. They blew up Nineveh. Because Nineveh is where they found this massive collection of, I think it was thousands of these clay tablets with the writing. And they found hundreds, I think it was almost 400 of them, they found in Amarna, which was... a capital city from a pharaoh that was monotheistic, the only pharaoh that was monotheistic. He tried to convince everybody to worship one god in Egypt. He was the, I want to say, grandfather or great-grandfather of Tutankhamun, of King Tut.
Akhenaten.
Yeah, Akhenaten. He was like the great-grandson of the guys during the Exodus, and the great-grandfather of King Tut, Akhenaten. So that's really cool. And there's a bunch of weird stuff about that. You want to get like freaked out on a sort of a spiritual kind of like a new agey way, go study some Akhenaten, because he was fixated on the sun. Like, and not just the sun, but like the concept of a sun. And I don't know if that... I honestly think that he was like touched somehow by God, and he was hearing son, and he was hearing Jesus, but he was thinking son, and so there's some confusion. It's like the son represented by a son, but it's more like the cross as a representation thing. It's like, it's not like worshiping the son, like he got the son was a big ball of fire sun thing. He got that. It was like a representation of the son was the symbol. So there's this real major confusion, because most atheists want basically just to attribute it to a sun-worshipping cult. But that doesn't work, because they're so far past that. Sun-worshipping is an early Paleolithic thing. They had grown up. They had grown into all these pantheon of gods and all these stories of Ra and Set and all this stuff. They're way past just, hey, let's worship the sun. So it's not that simple. And when you read this stuff, it doesn't appear that simple. The stuff that he has, and they try to destroy it after him because they weren't very happy about his monotheism. You know, one God plan did not go well in Egypt, okay? And so they tried to destroy it. So we don't have a lot of the stuff, but there, you get this feel that it's not just, you know, it's not a sun-worshipping thing. It may be a sun-like worshipping thing. You know what I mean? But there's a God thing involved. There's a monotheism. The point is that they discovered he kept all these communications from his father and himself, and they put them into a library. And so they find it called the Amarna Letters, and there's all kinds of really fun stuff in there, like stuff from Canaanite kings trying to ask the Egyptian pharaohs for help because somebody's invading and kicking their butt. I couldn't imagine who that was. I go through all these discussions all the time. Is there any possible reason that the population of Canaan would go down dramatically from 1500 to 1300? I'm like, besides Joshua killing everybody? Like, literally, that was a question in my class. It was an actual question, because they think that the coming of the Israelites is 1200, right? So, but in Canaan, between 1500, they have an actual, archaeologists have figured out the population of Canaan around 1500 BC, and they figured out the population of Canaan around 1300 BC. And it's dramatically different, okay? It's like dramatically different. And so the question comes up in the class, what could have possibly happened? Was it a drought? Was it a disease? What could have possibly happened to kill a ton of Canaanites around 1400? I'm like, a bunch of crazy Israelites killing them and taking their cities and establishing this new Israel. They killed a lot of people, you know? And there's a big bunch of populations missing. And they're tracking it in the Canaanite city, right? So the Canaanite city here, and the same Canaanite city here. And here it has, you know, 50,000 people, and here it has 5,000 people. What could have possibly happened? You know, bad disease, you know, skin rash, you know, asps, lots of asps, just a ton of them. Like snakes everywhere. It's like Samuel L. Jackson movie. There was that many snakes. Different kind of plane. But anyway, the point is that it was the Israelites killing everybody, but they can't do that. It just can't register. So anyway, keep praying for me. I'll be there live and in person in July. That'll be great. We'll see.
Can't let the Bible be right.
Yeah, they can't. It's this generation. Now after this and before this, there's people that are cool. But this one generation. There's several major works that came out in the mid-70s. And people from that generation, it's like, you just can't let the Bible be true. You just can't. It's like, it's sad. Anyway, we finished 20 and 21, and we went through another time of Abraham trying to claim that Sarah was a sister. But this time we figured out maybe she is kind of his sister. Maybe he's not just making it up. Maybe it's a defensive mechanism, certainly, but... And then once again, we got the story of Hagar and Ishmael, and they left, and they, you know, she thought they were going to die. This makes life really hard, right? This understanding, it makes life really, really hard, because before Abraham did that, God said, "I'm going to give your progeny, your kids are going to have all this land." He was referring to the Middle East. And then Abraham did what he did and created another son that wasn't the son of promise. And that son has to be blessed with a great nation. And they have to also inherit the same land. Then he got specific with Isaac about Israel. And Isaac, of course, has, you know, the great blessings and all of that stuff. But this is the exact story of what's happening right now. The people that came out of Ishmael were made into a great nation. The Muslims are a great nation. It's the second biggest religion in the world. And isn't that fascinating that it's the second biggest? I mean, it's like Christianity spread like wildfire from Paul on, right? And took over the world. And it's growing all the time. And of course, in some pockets, it's not growing so well. For more on that, see Europe. Okay, there's problems. But most of the places, it's growing rapidly. It's strong. But growing rapidly right behind it, almost like an echo. Right? So there's the son of promise I'll make a great nation out of with all this blessing. You have another son. Okay, I'm still going to make a great nation. And it repeats it in Genesis 21. Again, he says, Hagar, don't worry. I'm still going to make Ishmael into a great nation. But this is so crazy. And they're in the same land, the Middle East. Because they were given the same land. That's so crazy. I mean, just the idea. I mean, I don't even know. I don't even want to leave the house. Okay, just the idea that one guy, that Abraham could do that, and that could happen like that. But of course, God knew that, right? I mean, that's part of the plan. I don't know how it functions, but it's part of the plan. You know, it's going to bring us to where we need to be, one way or the other. But it's just mind-boggling.
God's pretty good at creating tension.
Yeah, it's...
I mean, He wants you to make a decision, but so he, and I don't know if I'm even saying that right, Victor. I mean, God create the tension, or is just the battle between good and evil, you know, God and Satan. Man, down through history, there's just been so much, you know, so many wars and so many battles between people who were all convinced they were right. You know, Muslims are, nobody's more convinced than they are that they're right. And they're dead wrong, but you can't tell them that.
You got to pick a side. The point is, if everybody lives in peace and harmony, you never have to pick a side. So I know it's weird to talk about. I know it's kind of like difficult philosophical ground. But the bottom line is, nothing bad ever happens to you, you don't grow. And if nothing, and if there's no stress or threat, you don't have to make a decision, right? If, you know, why would you pay your mortgage if they never ask you for it? Ain't nothing ever happened. They're not going to take your house. No one cares. Keep that $1,000 or that $2,000 or whatever. Who cares? You only pay your mortgage because you have to. If you don't, they take your house. There's a threat involved. There's pressure involved. I mean, it might be like one person out of 100 that'd be like, I'm going to write this check anyway. Just because that's who I am. All right. Power to you. Okay. But you see, there you have to make a decision. You can't be on the fence. When this world is like it is, when the battle between good and evil is so intense, when this is happening in that place so intensively, you can't sit on the fence. You're going to have to make a decision, right? So, I mean, it is. It's dicey philosophical ground. It's hard to discuss. It's hard to understand. But the bottom line is, it is like that. And that we are a people that have free will. And we are living behind enemy lines in a fallen world. And it's going to create tension, pressure, and danger from all sides. And we're going to have to figure out how we're going to deal with that. Are we going to deal with the danger around us in our own authority and under our own power and think that we're going to handle it? Or are we going to understand that it comes from a bigger source, that it's more universal, that our enemies aren't necessarily human flesh and blood, but their powers and principalities beyond us, and we need a power and a principality beyond us on our team? Are we going to understand how the world really works? Are we going to walk around like we're on, you know, it's all on Discovery Channel and we're all just animals and, you know, we're just going to do whatever? You know, that's not going to work, by the way. You can mumble around and stumble around, you're just going to get killed. You're going to get rolled over. Because if you don't pick a side, they're going to pick one for you. They're going to bury you. Because one side or the other, they're going to have to. Because if you get caught in the middle, you got to pick a side, man. I know it's at that. Like I said, that's hard. That's a very difficult thing to explain to people. You know, when they ask questions, when they're very, very young Christians or not quite Christian at all yet, but they're, you know, curious and have questions. This is a very tough line of questioning when it comes to how the world works and how good and evil work. It's a tough line of questioning. But it has to do with free will, because he doesn't want slaves. He could have made a pack of slaves that did whatever he said. That wasn't the deal. It wasn't the deal. It was about community. It's about family, honestly. You know, being part of the family, a real family. I mean, we all have families, and, you know, some more than others, and some of the family members are dicey. I get it. But just imagine a family where everybody really is dedicated to each other. Everybody really loves each other. All the parents and the grandparents and the kids, and everybody's just a real family where there's real love and real compassion for each other, and real people get raised by people that really love them and protect them. That family, I've heard about it. I don't have it. You know, my family is closer. The family that I come from, not so much, right? The family I'm creating is hopefully more in the image of God, hopefully, right? But that's what God wants, as a family. He wants people that come and really love and really care and have real compassion for each other. You know? I think that's a beautiful vision. I agree with God. I mean, that's not my job. I mean, he doesn't need me to agree with him. But I agree completely that would be a wonderful thing, where people really, truly love you. Like, behind your back, they still love you. You know? They never said, and they never say anything bad about anybody. I mean, love permeates all. What an awesome dream. That's God's dream. That's his vision. But you have to have free will to do that. To not talk bad about somebody, you have to make the decision not to talk bad about somebody. If you don't have any choice, you can't, then it doesn't matter. It's got to be a choice. You have to be able to do whatever you want to do. I can go out and rob a bank right now. I can shoot up the street. I can do whatever I want. I can do whatever I want to do. That has to be like that. I have to be able to do whatever I want to do, or my decision to follow God doesn't matter. Does that make sense? It has to be. We have to have free will. And of course, if he's going to give us free will, a whole bunch of people are going to mess everything up. So you can't have it one way. You can't have your cake and eat it too. Or eat your cake and have it too. There's a technical twist in that. I think it's quoted wrong. But anyway, the bottom line is you can't. Huge geek. That was a major geek statement right there. Okay. Anyway.
Kind of like a guy told me one time. He said, "I don't agree with this pi r squared thing. Pi are round. Cake are square sometimes."
Yeah, like a sheet cake is square. Pi r squared.
That was out of nowhere.
Pi r square. Pi are not square. Cake are square. That's funny. All right, that's another another geek joke. I get it. Anybody have
anything?
Are we brothers?
We got to be related
somehow. All the way back to Abraham somehow. Does anybody have anything that's not quite so geeky to talk about?
What I keep thinking about is you know, you've got the tension between Christians and Muslims. But there's tremendous tension between Christian and Jews. If you look at the really Hasidic Jews, the real guys that are still over there in Israel, one of the classes I had, or tour we had, the professor brought in a guy who was a good friend of his who was 100% still Jewish. And he talked to us for a while, and I was thinking, and he was talking about history and geography more than religion. But I was thinking, I wonder if that guy just thinks we're all just nuts. Because here we are believing in Christ, who he does not believe in. But he must be pretty kind. I know he's very brilliant from what he's saying. But he's coming over here talking to all these Pentecostal Christians about stuff, and we're not on the same page. Basically we are, but when it comes to Jesus, we're not.
The tension,
it's wild, isn't it?
I think the tension gets tighter the closer to home you get. So you're talking to, like, you know, like I used to hang out with Buddhist monks all the time. They had like free vegetarian meals, and I was like semi-homeless, and so I just hung out with the Buddhist monks, who I thought were awesome, by the way. I love the Buddhist monks. I've continued some of those relationships. But the further away somebody is from your cultures and ideas, it's like the less tension. And as you bring it in, it gets tighter and tighter. So very few problems with Buddhists, more problems with Muslims, more problems with Jews, more problems with other Christians, right? You reel it all the way in, and it's like, I had two things happen simultaneously, and I just ran around like shaking my head and screaming, like with my hair on fire, which I don't have. But if I had hair, it would have been on fire. The first one was they showed on the news this pastor trying to get his fifth jet. Have you seen this guy?
Oh, yeah.
$58 million or whatever. And he's like, "Oh, God's going to give me that jet in cash," and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, who is giving this piece of dung anything, right? And he's one of the main pastors of the whole, you know, prosperity gospel and blah. And I'm just like, and we're relatively close. I believe that God makes people prosper. I mean, he believes roughly in the Bible. We're not that far apart, but he's infuriating. Here's another step out from there. The new attack that's happening, and I don't know if you guys know about the Jehovah's Witnesses, what's going on, but all these reports have come out. It looks now like systematic pedophilia. Like thousands of people. I'm talking about people doing it. Tens of thousands of probable victims. It's just this huge new thing. There's a brand new show about it. There's actually two brand new shows about it, kind of simultaneously. But they've had this. What it was a cover-up The way that they do it is the ruling council makes the decisions on things. And it's similar to what happened in the Catholic Church, basically. But it's a smaller number of people, and it's much bigger, much wider spread within that number. So the Catholics, you got like, you know, half a billion people or whatever, and there is a large amount of problems, but this is like more like a huger percentage. And all these people have come forward, and basically the one of the ladies who was one of their like leaders has started recording all the stuff, and she got all the files, and evidently it's like thousands of people involved in it, from all over the world, basically. But anyway, it was so they would go take it to the leadership, and the leadership, of course, oh, by the way, no women are allowed to be in any form of leadership, even a low-level leadership, which means that you're taking information about an adult male leader to a couple more adult male leaders who are his friends, basically. So they make the call, and out of the 1,000 files that she had, not one of them was reported to authorities, not one. So anyway, that's a huge meltdown happening right now with the Jehovah's Witnesses. You can look up more on that. That one was a little more shocking to me than, I mean, everybody knows Scientology is, you know, nonsense. I was there for sort of how that stuff got started because I was studying science fiction and he was a science fiction author. So I knew a lot about L. Ron Hubbard. But everybody knows Scientology is ludicrous. But this was kind of like a lot closer because we've got, you know, where is it? Like, it's right over there. We've got a Kingdom Hall. They call them Kingdom Halls so people don't think they're churches. Anyway, there's a whole big focus on the end times and the theology that they have about the end times and the apocalypse is not biblical. All those who were here for the Revelation study remember how small and insignificant those battles actually are in Revelation. They literally last seconds and nothing happens. But people have focused all their energy on this great, you know, apocalypse that's coming, and it's really not like that. But I mean, it is in a way, obviously. There's a bunch of problems, but it's not like this big, the type of thing that they're focusing on. Anyway, so that's all that stuff's been happening recently in the last week or two. All these kind of things are kind of blowing up. I don't know what that means. I just know that the tension is very, very high in the world right now.
Did the guy go on Fox News, or did Fox News just... I didn't ever see him on there. I know it's true, but I didn't know if he was stupid enough to go on Fox News and say that.
I saw an interview where he was standing in the hall pointing at the... He has pictures in the hall of the planes.
Yeah.
And he's pointing at the plane. He said, paid with cash, pay with cash, pay with cash. And he was talking about the new one would be pay with cash and how it had a better gas tank so he could spread the word further or whatever he was talking about.
Jesse Duplantis.
Okay. Yeah, Jesse Duplantis.
He preached in our church in Texas one time.
Lord have mercy. Lord have mercy.
Well, that was a long time
ago. No, people change. People learn, people change, things change, man. This guy has lost his cotton-picking mind. I can't remember the last thing he said, but he said something. He quoted something about the Bible, but he quoted it like with a twist about how. Oh yeah, he said he didn't. He said, you know, we don't have to get around on donkeys anymore. Something like that. Basically, how you know things change and you know we don't have to ride on donkeys anymore. Basically, we need private jets. And I don't know. I mean, Andy and I put a request into the central campus for a jet. I don't know if they're gonna, you know.
They sent you know, one of those little balsa wood things.
Yes. Here's your jet. Here's your private jet. Man, that kind of stuff. I mean, it just infuriates me. It just makes my job harder. Makes it more difficult to explain to people, especially people that are not Christian and are in other countries, you know, like England or France or whatever. It makes it very difficult to explain when all they see is this nonsense like that. It makes it very hard to explain the truth of the gospel to people, you know.
When he came Actually, Pastor Todd invited him to our church in Texas. He was really big at the time and had a big church and was pretty popular, very, very good speaker. But his deal to come was at the time when Pastor Todd left and went to California, I was still there as the interim pastor. And he came and his deal was, I will come preach at your church if you let me receive the offering. And he preached about 30, 35 minutes on giving. That wasn't his message. That was the lead into the offering. And he said, I need a $10,000 offering tonight.
Wow.
And he got it.
Oh, yeah.
There were people there. People came from Louisiana. They came from all over the place to hear him speak. And he was a fabulous speaker.
Well, he definitely didn't get that much power by not being motivational. You know, he's got to be a great speaker. He's got to be highly motivated.
But the prosperity thing can get off into some real weird areas, though.
I mean, it opens up the door for a whole lot of questions, like, how does it work? I mean, for instance, if you're anointed, if you're speaking in such a way that it's causing great movements of things to happen, does God pull it when you go off track, but you still have it or not? How does it work? You know, is it a skill set that human beings can have without God? Or was he originally anointed, or does it stay? An anointed stays on that person because that person's still a person of God, even though they're off track a little bit? How does it work? You know, that's a big, I don't have an answer, by the way. That's a big question for me. Because we talked about this when one of the local pastors had a big fall, and I was talking to a couple members of the church about it, and I was like, you know, their point of view was it doesn't change what he did because all these people got saved. They have their own lives now where they've been saved and they're leading their lives now and they're getting closer to God. And he did that even though he might now be off track. He might now be fallen or whatever it is. And that's a tough discussion right there. And it is. It's a tough discussion.
Well, it starts with, does God want to bless his people? Well, yeah, he does want to bless his people. Yeah. And, you know, the Bible does talk a little bit about prosperity. But any doctrine taken to the max can get off track. Doesn't matter what the doctrine is. You can go out in left field with almost anything if you push it hard enough and think about it long enough and stretch it out and turn it into something that's really not. Yeah. And
that's you know, tough.
Some of the prosperity stuff goes there. It's a little crazy.
Yeah, one of the things that gets me about it is obviously America, people giving their money, all that stuff. I get it, but then that stuff goes to other countries where people don't really have stuff, and they're in a position where they really think like this is my way out of poverty. And like Nigeria, Nigeria's a huge prosperity gospel place, right? And people really feel like this is their way out, and it's so tricky and weird. Some of the stuff that you see in Africa is just really, really strange. Like there's these guys that were kind of competing for parishioners, and one guy changed his name to Bishop, and so the other guy changed his name, his title to bigger Bishop. He literally called himself Bigger Bishop, which I found hilarious. And so we were just waiting when I was there for the other guy to come out with his announcement. He was an even bigger Bishop. I'm like, really? Is this what's really going on? But yeah, these are churches of, you know, 100,000 people. This is Africa, you know, so you've got hundreds of thousands of people and you're the bigger bishop. So I don't know, man. I don't know. One of the guys' name is actually Dollar. Creflo Dollar.
Creflo Dollar.
I wouldn't necessarily trust a pastor whose name was actually Dollar. Like, give me your money and my name is Dollar. Anyway, I don't know.
He's rolling in the dough, too.
He definitely is, yeah. There's even a show about some of these guys. Like it's like the Housewives type shows, but it's like the pastors of Atlanta or something. There's like a show about it. I'm like, come on, man. Gold cars or whatever. I don't know. It's just ridiculous. But anyway, Abraham started all that. That's all I'm trying to say.
There's this preacher that was on TV for a long time. Pastor Todd was talking to us about it. And he was so into grace. Grace was everything. And of course, grace is vital important. But he decided that because it was grace, he was saved and it was grace, it didn't really matter what he did, because the grace of God was going to carry him. And so he would have his television program, his preaching television program. He'd be sitting in a really nice double stuffed chair with a big old long cigar,
yeah,
preaching, you know, teaching and telling you to send in his offerings and talking about grace and,
nope,
you know, anything taken to the max can lead you straight off track.
Yep, that's it. Speaking of off track, so we're gonna reel it in. No, it's vital information. All this stuff. I know we kind of zigzagged a bit tonight, but there's a bunch of good information in there. And I was really worried when we first started studying Genesis that it would kind of drag on, but it doesn't. There's all these sections where these stories, and you learn all these things. You're like, oh, okay. We're gonna go through as we continue through into Isaac and Jacob and everything. And there's so many lessons to be learned. But we'll talk about Isaac pretty soon. I don't know if we'll make it to the history of camels and ancient zoology next time. But so next class is actually fusion. Okay, so next week's fusion, and so the week after that we have class, and we have class for a couple weeks in June, and then the last week of June, the last Wednesday is the last one, and then July, there's no fusion or class because of all the stuff that's going on with traveling and everything. And we'll be back into action the first Wednesday of August after that. So we'll take the month of July off just because they have so many things that are happening when it comes to the movie nights and it comes to the stuff. If you want to stay involved, there's going to be the farmers market ministry is going to be going full force in July. There'll be a couple of those movie nights we're going to have. There's just so much stuff going on that you can get involved. But most people are going to be taking vacations and moving around. So, all right, let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for tonight. Please protect everyone here and help them draw closer to you. Help us all draw closer to you with more and more knowledge of who you are and what you want to show us. I know there's a lot of zigzagging tonight, so try to coalesce some of that information and give us some enlightenment as to what you're trying to say to us in the Word and how we need to live our lives. Just have your way with us and pull us closer and closer to you. Protect everyone here, their homes, their families, their finances, their travel, their vehicles, everything about their life and their health. Just lift them up and strengthen and protect them, so that they can better serve you. We love you so much, and we thank you so much for this place and everyone here and this ability to meet like this and discuss the Word. We know how blessed we are, and we thank you. And we pray all these things in the mighty name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
My favorite guy that I've probably ever had